Blog Talk Radio.
Delving past the headlines, sorting through the media bias, exposing the propaganda, and challenging you to use your brain. It's time to tap into the truth.
Yes, that's right. Ladies and gentlemen, it is indeed time to tap into the truth. Welcome to today's broadcast. Hope you're having a great day wherever you are and whatever you may be doing. Today is a soggy and overcast day here in East Tennessee, but at least the temperatures are still a bit warmer than they have been and certainly getting a brief window into spring. And certainly have enjoyed it to this point. A lot of the regular listeners, I'm sure, noticed I was not on last week. For those of you who have not yet heard, previous to that, this past week, my father has passed away, and I have not been particularly active the last little bit. However, as sadly missed as my father is, and as hard as that is, there are a few things that I know that he would not look kindly upon, and one of them is to be silent when the nation is in such dire straits. We didn't always agree politically. Unfortunately, he was a Democrat, but he was a Democrat from a different time. He was not about the progressives, and he was slowly coming around to the fact that the party he once loved no longer was the same party. Despite the fact that we still greatly disagreed about what the role of government should be in helping people, he is still the person that taught me conservative values and a hard work ethic. He was a man that believed we should help each other. Just disagreed with how we should go about doing that. He did not believe that people would take advantage of social programs. He believed the best in people, and that much I wish I could feel stronger about. It's hard when it's so fresh. But this battle goes on, and the enemy, those who would destroy our Constitution, those who would take our freedoms, are constantly on the march. I want to give a shout-out to Mary, who's currently in the chat room. Thank you for being here. I appreciate the sentiment and kind words that you've extended in regards to the health of my father in the past. All that, we do have guests on today. And we will start with Mr. Michael Conley. He has been on the show before, and he is, of course, the current executive director of the United States Justice Foundation, as well as being a constitutional attorney. He has been an educator. He is an author. He is a radio show host, doing his own podcast as well, has his own website connected to the website with the United States Justice Foundation. Thanks for being with us today, sir. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Thanks for having me on.
Well, you are always welcome here, sir. I appreciate your individual efforts and the efforts that the United States Justice Foundation is doing. Today, I wanted to talk a little bit about your efforts in fighting against Obamacare to start with. You guys are very active in leading the charge there. What are some of the things that you're doing right now?
Well, we're involved in four different lawsuits and involving the HHS mandate on religious institutions and businesses owned by religious families who don't want to have to pay for contraception and for abortion services for their employees. There are four of those cases that we filed briefs in the courts of appeal. Two of them have now been accepted for review by the Supreme Court, so we'll be filing a brief in those. We also are going to be supporting the Pacific Legal Foundation when their case, which is now in the Court of Appeals, gets to the Supreme Court, or they try to get to the Supreme Court, because that case involves the origination clause of the Constitution, which specifically says that any law involving taxes or revenue must originate in the House of Representatives. And, of course, Obamacare, there originally was one filed in the House of Representatives, but that didn't go anywhere. So what they did is they went through the Senate with it, and they basically took a House bill that was totally unrelated, wiped it clean, and then put in the Obamacare, and they're claiming, oh, it originated in the Senate. Well, our claim is that that's not true, that's a lie, and therefore it violates the Constitution, and the whole thing needs to be thrown out. So that's part of what we're involved in as far as Obamacare goes.
How are things moving in that direction? Are you catching traction as far as the arguments are concerned, or is there a legal wrangling that's pushing back and making it difficult for those cases to move forward?
Well, the cases are moving forward. Like I said, the Supreme Court has accepted two of them and consolidated them on the HHS mandate, and we have contradictory rulings from lower courts. Some courts have ruled it is unconstitutional to force religious institutions and businesses owned by religious families to provide these services. Others have said that's not the case. That's why the Supreme Court will ultimately decide it. We feel like we have some very strong arguments in those cases, and we'll be expressing them along with many other groups out there who are involved in these cases at the Supreme Court level. We'll be filing a brief. I'll be working with our attorneys, our staff of attorneys on that, to make sure it's a well-reasoned brief and something that the Supreme Court, hopefully a majority, will grab a hold of. We feel like we also have a strong, the Pacific Legal Foundation has a strong case, and it's moving forward. It's in the Court of Appeals right now. No decision has been made yet. But either way, we know it will go to the Supreme Court, or at least they'll attempt to take it to the Supreme Court. And if the ruling is against us, in that case, against Pacific Legal Foundation, then we will join with them in supporting a writ of certiorari to get the case in the Supreme Court. So we feel like we're moving along and that we do have some traction here.
Okay. Is it necessary to take specific businesses in this case, or would it be possible if these cases, for whatever reason, if the rulings went against you in here, isn't there a level that common citizens that just have a conscientious feeling of not wanting to have their taxpayer dollars go to fund abortions, could they not file a lawsuit too, or do you have to have some different level of standing?
Well, we pretty much have to have a different level of standing. I wish that taxpayers could get standing to file lawsuits in this area and many others, because obviously the taxpayers are being fleeced here, and many of them are being forced to see their tax dollars spent on unconstitutional things they do not believe in. But the courts have consistently ruled that individuals, there must be some harm to the individual, and they've ruled that having to pay taxes is not sufficient harm to create standing. So we have these businesses that clearly have standing. The courts have ruled that they have standing because they're being affected directly by it. They're in danger of losing their livelihood because they're going to be subjected to fines of $10,000 a day if they don't go along with this. And so places like Sahabi Lobby have actually said that they're going to shut down their corporation, and that will cost thousands of jobs around the country. But they can't afford to pay the fines. So they clearly have standing, so that's why we're going with the businesses and religious institutions at this point.
Mm-hmm. It's always been an interesting question to me, and of course, some of this I know, and some of these questions I'll ask you just so that you can explain it to folks, because, you know, I can sit here and preach to the choir all day, but it's obviously I'm not an attorney. You, of course, are a learned scholar in the area. You've practiced constitutional law. You're very active in it, and you can give a much better explanation than I could. But, is the abortion issue the only issue that we're having right now that individual businesses can push back on as far as the Obamacare, or is there any other arguments that are currently being formulated?
Well, the abortion issue and the contraception issue are directly involved in the HHS mandate. which we believe goes outside of the bounds of the law to begin with, outside the bounds of Obamacare, much less outside the bounds of the Constitution. So that's a very strong argument. Now, there are other possibilities out there, particularly, and you know, I would like to see, and we will certainly be involved in it if it happens, I would like to see a member of Congress out there file a suit against Obama, and, you know, there are suits on the periphery of this, but I would like to see somebody file a suit against Obama for doing the executive orders and amending this law, something like 30 times now. He's amended this law. He's changed the dates on mandates. He's changed the requirements on the mandates in the law. The law was passed by Congress. Article 2 of the Constitution says that the President of the United States shall do everything in his power to enforce the laws passed by Congress. It doesn't say that he can change the laws. It doesn't say he can make the laws. It doesn't say he can ignore the laws and decide which ones to enforce and which ones not to. Obama does all of those things in violation of Article 2 on a daily basis, really. And so he's done this on numerous occasions on Obamacare, and I think that there are some businesses out there, in addition to a member of Congress, but a member of Congress would certainly be a very strong plaintiff here, saying essentially that the president has violated the Constitution, has taken away my right to represent my constituents. And, you know, some senators should have done this back when the czars were being appointed. And I said then I couldn't understand why nobody was doing it, but nobody did. Because you have the Constitution specifically saying that what the president can do and what Congress can do. Congress can pass the laws. The president then has to enforce those laws. Amending the laws on his own violates the Constitution, and so the members of Congress who voted for this or voted against it cannot represent their constituents and authorize changes in the law or oppose changes in the law because Obama's doing it on his own. So I think that would be a very, very strong case, and we're certainly looking into that and will be involved. If somebody comes forward to us and wants us to get involved in such a case, we'll certainly take a close look at it, see if we can get standing, and if somebody else files a lawsuit, we will be involved in supporting that lawsuit.
Okay. Well, you know, I have actually, in past broadcasts, read the limiting powers and actual authority that an executive order has, and there's still a lot of confusion about that to the average person. Would you mind explaining what the limitations on it, the actual authority that an executive order has, and why that simply isn't within his power, constitutionally speaking, to make these delays and, quote, amend the laws?
Well, basically, the Constitution doesn't really talk about executive orders. The Constitution does say that the President of the United States should enforce the laws passed by Congress. Executive orders were designed and approved by the Supreme Court years ago basically to allow the president to do that, to take necessary actions that would enforce the laws passed by Congress and help implement those laws. Executive actions were primarily supposed to be taken if something occurred while Congress was in recess and some immediate action had to be taken. For example, if our national security was involved, the president could act. But once the Congress comes back into session, then Congress has the power to almost ratify what the president has done, basically, or can set aside what the president has done. So executive orders are designed to be fairly limited. Unfortunately, over the years, and this went on before Obama became president, but he's certainly taken it to a whole new level, certain presidents were issuing executive orders, which I felt were unconstitutional. But they didn't have the impact of what Obama's doing has. Obama is basically not using executive orders just to enforce laws passed by Congress. He's using executive orders and agency actions by his agencies in the executive branch to implement laws that Congress refused to pass. Cap and trade is a primary example. It passed the House of Representatives when it was democratically controlled, but was defeated in the Senate because even the Democrats in the Senate at that point saw that it was a danger to the economy and certainly it would caused massive increases in our energy prices. Obama has decided he's going to implement that law anyway by executive order, by agency action. He has an EPA going out and trying to shut down many coal mines in this country, shut down coal-fired utility plants. We're looking at the Americans seeing a 300% increase in their utility cost over the next couple of years. Obama's doing all of this on his own, and he's doing it without Congress approving it. that is far outside the bounds of executive orders. What he's doing on the Second Amendment is even worse, because as far as I'm concerned, and I agree with Mark Levine on this, the Second Amendment is there. It is in, set in stone that Congress shall not infringe upon the rights of the people to keep and bear arms. If Congress can't infringe on that right, and the Constitution says they can't, then Congress should not even be having up and down votes on things like gun registration or universal gun registration or universal background checks, any of this. Yet Obama, since he can't get through Congress what he wants, he is doing it by executive order. His most recent executive order, which clearly violates the Constitution, is where he amended the HIPAA law, which is the law that establishes your right to privacy of your medical records. He is basically telling the states that they are to take the medical records of anybody who's ever been treated for depression or even told their doctor they were feeling depressed, anybody with PTSD, and this is particularly aimed at veterans. They've been doing this in the VA for a while, and we'll talk about that more in a few minutes, I think. But
yeah,
he is extending this to say that, okay, if you've ever taken certain medications for ADHD or for ADD, you are going to be put, he's telling the state, send this information to the FBI so they can put these people on the list of people who cannot purchase firearms, the next list. They, in other words, he's using phony mental illness, because PTSD is not a mental illness, according to scientists. It is not. Yet, and the requirement for being on that list of people who cannot purchase firearms in this country is to be either a convicted felon, a known drug abuser, or someone who has been adjudicated to be mentally defective to the point of being a danger to themselves or others. Having gone to your doctor sometime in the past and saying, look, I lost a family member unexpectedly and I've been a little depressed about it, that does not make you mentally ill. Having PTSD because you've been in an automobile accident or in combat overseas does not make you mentally ill. Yet they are pushing the bounds, and this is exactly what other dictatorships have done. The Soviet Union, they did it. Adolf Hitler was very good at this, declaring people mentally ill, because that way they bypass the court process. Eric Holder has come out and said the adjudication process does not mean a judge or administrative judge has to have a hearing to decide if you're mentally ill. That's the way the law works. But he said, no, we don't have to do that. We can have some minor bureaucrat in the VA or in the EPA or the Justice Department declare you mentally ill without ever talking to you, without ever having you examined by a doctor or a psychiatrist, simply because we've decided that because you own a gun or you want to purchase a gun, we're going to stop you from doing it. So that's the way they're perverting the executive orders and perverting the agency actions. You know, that's just one more example.
You know, what continues to boggle my mind when it comes to the issue of these executive orders is that so few people who actually do have standing refuse to take court action. I mean, I don't understand why so many people are sitting back. I understand to a degree why certain senators might not necessarily be on board with that, just because they're trying to advance the power of their party. But why the other senators and why the folks over in the House of Representatives aren't standing up and pushing this into court, because they're being completely taken out of the process. The Constitution is literally, we've gone from being chipped away at to they're taking a jackhammer and a sledgehammer and they're completely demolishing the process. And we've gotten to a point where everyday citizens are more concerned about their, well, right now, for example, their NCAA brackets than the real peril to our individual freedoms and liberties that each one of these little steps take. I don't think people really understand the danger in having our veterans having the right to own a firearm being taken from them on this bogus, made-up stuff. And I do want to talk more about that, too, because that's really one of my favorite things that you're doing right now, quite honestly. It's what I'm most excited that you guys are working on, and that's defending the rights of our veterans. I've said a multitude of times that there are two groups of people in this country that should never have to worry about our government breaking promises to them. one is seniors and the other is our veterans. And those people have done what was asked of them and were fortunate enough in many cases to come back from conflict. They should not have to worry about if the government is going to cut their pension while, of course, let's say in the case of the legislature, going to give themselves raises while they're cutting the pensions of our armed military veterans. How are the cases that you're working on right now to help defend the veterans' rights proceeding?
Well, they're proceeding. The first one is proceeding very well. We, in fact, have won a victory in the first case. And the first case involved the veterans involved us going to the VA and filing Freedom of Information Act request, which they ignored. We took them to court, and the court ruled that they have to turn over information to us. And we've gotten some very damaging information. But in a nutshell, this is what is developed here. And I broke this story about a year ago, and we've been working on this ever since. And if any veterans out there are listening and have been affected by this, please contact us at usjf.net. That's United States Justice Foundation initials, usjf.net. And let us know, because we're representing veterans for free here. We're not going to be charging them or their families anything. We're going to try to raise our money independently for this, and we estimate it's going to cost a quarter to $500,000. But it has to be done, because here's what's happening. Veterans are getting letters in the mail, and I've got copies of these letters. These are not things that are made up. I've got copies of letters in which the veterans are being told, because of your physical or mental disabilities, we're going to declare you incompetent to handle your own financial affairs and appoint a fiduciary to represent you. Now, the fiduciary program has been around the VA for a number of years, and it's a good program initially designed to help veterans who might be suffering from dementia, who might be getting real old and couldn't pay their own bills. And so usually a family member would be appointed to handle their affairs. The problem is that what the Obama administration has done, starting in 2009, not long after he was elected, is they start using all types of things to declare people incompetent. Veterans are being declared incompetent because they have minor PTSD. And of course, we have Dianne Feinstein in the United States Senate saying on the floor of the Senate that all veterans have PTSD and therefore all should be denied the right to own firearms. She actually said this. Well, this is what the VA is trying to do. Minor PTSD, minor depression. We have veterans out there. We've documented, because we've seen it in writing, that they're being declared incompetent to handle their own financial affairs because they let their spouses pay the family bills. We have one veteran whose wife works in a bank, so she just handles all the bills through the bank, and they have declared him incompetent for that. Some veterans are being declared incompetent for no reason whatsoever. They're given no reason. There's no due process here. But these letters go on to say to the veterans, once we've declared you incompetent, you can no longer own, purchase, possess, or transport firearms or ammunition. If you do, you will be charged with a felony under the provisions of the Brady Handgun Act. And, you know, this resulted in 159,000 veterans that we know of so far being put on the list, the next list of people who cannot legally purchase firearms in this country. As I said, there's no due process here. What's happening is the veterans are getting these letters, and then if they want to appeal, the burden of proof is on them to prove that they're not incompetent. They have to hire their own private psychiatrist or psychologist. And most of this is not based on any of these veterans being evaluated by anybody in the VA from a psychological or psychiatric standpoint. This is based on some low-level bureaucrat, usually an outside contract worker, who gets the file, and somewhere in the file the veteran said, you know, has been diagnosed with PTSD, or somewhere in the file the veteran said, you know, I let somebody else pay my bills for me, or some veteran said, I lost a buddy in Afghanistan or Iraq, and I was depressed over that. They're taking this, and they're using that to put these veterans on the list. They are not being adjudicated to be mentally ill to the point of being in danger to themselves or others, and that's what the law requires. So they're being hammered right now, and again, the veterans are being told also, and this is extortion as far as I'm concerned, that if you do appeal this ruling, we're going to cut off your benefits during the time period the appeal is running, which may be up to 2 to 3 years, which means veterans who rely on their VA benefits that they've earned, in combat, and they've earned because they were very seriously injured in combat, they rely on that money to feed their families. And they're being told, we're going to cut off your bread to your children unless you acquiesce to what the VA wants you to do. So we're preparing a massive lawsuit on behalf of veterans, and I'm really looking for one here in Texas where I live, because we'd like to file, we'd file this suit anywhere, but we'd like to file it in Texas, because that way I can personally oversee this suit and be the lead attorney on it. So if we have any Texas veterans out there, please contact us. But we are going to be filing a lawsuit, and I'm preparing legal papers for that lawsuit, the complaint right now. We're going to be filing a lawsuit to stop this. Now, the Senate has twice tried to stop this. There was an amendment filed to the 2013 NDAA, National Defense Authorization Act, that was to protect the veterans from having this happen. That failed because Obama opposed it in the Senate. The Democrats opposed it. Then right after I broke this article last year, Senator Richard Burr of North Carolina filed a new bill called the Veterans Second Amendment Protection Act, which was designed to do the same thing, to stop this from happening. Obama opposed it. Again, it was defeated on an up-and-down vote in the Senate by the Senate Democrats. So the last chance these veterans have is in the courts, and we intend to go forward with this, and we intend to go forward with it full bore. Again, it's going to put massive drains on we're not a large legal foundation. We do not get $1 million a year from the President of Progressive Insurance like the ACLU does. We rely on small contributions. We'd love to get some big contributions, but we rely primarily on small contributions for people to give us the money to handle these cases. And the money goes to handle the cases. We try to spend as little as possible on administrative overhead. We have few employees, and none of them make a whole lot of money, including me. But we do this because we're dedicated. So if you're interested in donating, people can go to usjf.net. There's a link on the top of the homepage that says Donate to Us. You can click on that, and you can find out how to donate online or how to send us a check in the mail. If you want to designate the monies to specifically go for the veterans cases, you can do that. And so we're asking people to help us out. The contributions to us are tax deductible. We're a 501c3 organization. And so people can, you know, write it off on their income tax. If you want me to make speeches about this, I'm making speeches all over Texas and all around the country. If you want me to meet with private groups of people that might be willing to donate, I'm willing to do that too. We're willing to do whatever it takes to defend these veterans. I am a veteran. I've written a book about my father's unit during World War II, which has become a bestseller, a book called The Borderman. He was a veteran. I have two sons currently serving, one of whom has spent over 102 months in combat zones since 9/11. He's a combat engineer officer. My youngest son is a Black Hawk pilot. This is important to my family, but I also was commander of an American Legion post here in Texas for 2 years. I know these veterans. These are America's heroes. What's happening to them is unconscionable. Now, it's not just the gun control issue. We're also looking at other things, like veterans not getting the medical care that they need. But basically, the death panels are being set up in the VA to deny medical care to veterans. We've got veterans, young veterans, who will not go to the VA. And because I confirm this, the first thing they're being asked, and this is on direct orders from the White House, the first thing they're being asked when they go to the VA is, do you own a firearm? And then they're being asked a rather innocuous question at the end. We got two veterans in Kansas that alert us to this. They're being asked, well, if something happens to you and you become disabled, who do you want to be on your checking account to help pay your bills? And they'll say their father, mother, spouse, whoever. Two veterans that answered that question in Kansas got letters from the VA, letters I just mentioned, telling them they were going to be declared incompetent for that reason. Not because they've been declared incompetent, not because they have somebody else handling their affairs. It was simply because they said that if something happened to them, they were okay with their spouse doing it for them. So they're using obviously bogus reasons to put these veterans on the list. But there's, you know, the reason behind this is there are 21 million of us out there. We all took the same oath of office to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. We believe in that oath. We're trained to protect our country. We did not take an oath to Obama personally. We did not take an oath to members of Congress. We took an oath to the Constitution, to the American people, and a lot of us intend to defend that oath and defend the Constitution if necessary, and it looks like it's going to become necessary. So that's why they want to disarm us.
Okay. Yeah, I had a question strictly in your opinion. A lot of these agencies that are being used against veterans and against the patriotic citizens in general, the IRS, the VA, these are supposed to be non-political groups separate from the body politic, and they're supposed to serve the public good. And at one point in time, these bureaucrats that work in these positions serve that purpose. Why are there not more people, do you think, that see all this going on and come out verbally against it and just walk out the door?
Well, that's happening more and more, and I'll be perfectly honest with you. A lot of the information we've developed has come from inside the VA, and, of course, I'm not going to talk about the people who have provided me with information, but we have gotten some information from inside the VA, and I think more and more of them are on the verge of coming out and doing this, particularly the ones that are about to retire, because there's some disgust inside the VA. Obviously, in the IRS, you have a different situation. A lot of these people were trained to look with suspicion on the American public. You know, we're all tax evaders. We all should be punished. We all should have bad things happen to us. We all should have our free speech stifled. But all of this follows a pattern. And years ago, I read Mein Kampf, which is Adolf Hitler's book that he wrote in prison, and he talked there about what he saw, his vision for Germany. And he started following that vision. In 1933, he was elected Chancellor of Germany. And think about this, it took him 6 years before he finally brought all this to fruition. Obama's been in office about 5.5 years now. But what happened with Adolf Hitler was he decided to consolidate his power and declare himself a dictator. The first thing he did was nationalize the healthcare industry in Germany, feeling that if you can control access to healthcare, you can control the people. The second thing he did was start to disarm the German population, beginning with the veterans. He was scared of the veterans, just like Obama's scared of the veterans. The veteran German soldiers from World War I had taken an oath of office similar to the ones we take, and that is to defend their constitution, defend their country, not to defend an individual. So he started disarming the veterans and then the rest of the German population. The third thing he did was begin to purge all of the people in high-ranking positions in the military, in the German Army and Air Force, who were not loyal to him personally, who were loyal to the country. Now, all that sounds very familiar. The fourth thing he did was to start using mental illness as a weapon of war, a weapon of tyranny, and I've written an article on my blog talking about that, and not just in Nazi Germany, talking about how it's happening here, that the people were, the way that Hitler wanted to bypass the courts, the judiciary, with people that were opposed to him and had not committed any crime other than the fact they opposed him, he just had them declared mentally ill. He had them arrested. They never went to court. They never went before a judge. They never had a hearing of any kind. They were put in mental institutions or ultimately in concentration camps, and then they were worked to death or they were killed in some other fashion. And this was done to a lot of people. And, you know, we know about the Jews and how what they did to the Jews and to the gypsy population, and to everybody they felt inferior. But what they is not talked about as much is the fact that anybody who was a dissident, anybody who opposed Hitler or opposed his regime could have this same fate, and often did, suffered the same fate. And that's basically what you have the IRS and the VA doing at this point, is they're trying to shut down all opposition to the Obama administration, and particularly shut down those groups that are liable to be the most vocal and the most active in opposing, i.e. the veterans, the Tea Parties, the patriotic groups, the Christian groups, the pro-life groups, the Second Amendment groups. All of these are targets now, and it follows the pattern of every dictator in the history of the world, just about.
Right. I think I'm afraid that that's part of the reason why our educational system and our standards in the government schools, since they're certainly not designed to serve the public anymore, have been lowered so much, is so that there's not enough people that know enough of their past, that know enough and understand history to see these things repeating. But I want to ask your opinion on one other issue from this past week before I end up letting you go here in just a few. I wanted your thoughts on this past week's effort in the House of Representatives to pass a law requiring Obama to obey the law. Of course, it was mostly political theater, it looked like. I know we had some fine arguments from folks that are supposed to be representatives, even getting the age of the Constitution wrong by a considerable amount. What did you think about all that?
Well, you know, the idea is a good one, because here's what we have: a situation where the Supreme Court has in the past been reluctant to get involved in disputes between the executive branch and the legislative branch. And they have often ruled that the legislative branch or individual members of that branch, like congressmen or senators, don't have standing to challenge actions by the executive branch. But it's always been, you know, minor disputes. It hadn't been something major like the executive branch ignoring Article 2 of the Constitution or ignoring Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. So this was an effort, and there were basically two bills introduced. This was an effort, number one, to make sure that if the members of Congress wanted to go to the Supreme Court or to federal courts to challenge actions by the president outside of the Constitution, that they would have standing to do so. And secondly, it was just to require the president to stop doing what he's doing with these executive orders. Now, both of these bills were, you know, partisan bills, obviously. They were filed by the Republicans in the Republican House. And if they were passed, they might, with the situation in some Democrats find themselves in the Senate with the upcoming elections, they might have passed the Senate because of the fact that they are pretty innocuous bills. They basically say, okay, Mr. President, you have to follow the Constitution. You have to obey the laws of the land. Obama has said he will veto that if it passes both houses. Now, how ironic is that? We have a president of the United States who is saying he will veto legislation passed by Congress that forces him to follow the law and obey the Constitution. That is just another example of the lawlessness we have out here with this president. And I've written, you know, you talk about our young people not knowing what's going on. They're not being taught. I've written a booklet called Our Constitution, which takes every article, section, and amendment of the Constitution, prints it as originally written, and I put in my comments about it. I've had PhDs come to me and say, look, until we read your booklet, we had no idea that the words separation of church and state were not in the Constitution, which they're not. People are, you know, are telling me that we didn't understand the Second Amendment until you talked about it. Our children are not being taught. We're on a third printing of this booklet, and people can go to www.constitution.jigsy.com to order copies. Many copies are being ordered by, for example, a Rotary Club in South Texas bought 500 copies just to distribute to juniors in high school and sixth school district. We have a lot of people buying these just to carry around their pockets or purses so they can pull them out and show their liberal friends or the people that don't understand what the Constitution says that, look, here it is in black and white. This is what it says. We're denying our children an education about our form of government. They're being given false information under this Common Core business to the point where just here in Texas, in a county north of me, they have a synopsis, supposedly, of the Bill of Rights, which says, tell students that the Second Amendment only applies to an organized militia or the National Guard. It does not apply to individuals. Supreme Court has twice ruled that it does. So we have a blatant lie being taught to our school children.
Right. All right, sir. I appreciate your time today, and you are always welcome on this show, and I definitely want to continue to get updates on all of your legal efforts. These are two of the most important things going on right now, and it's always good to have a constitutional expert, someone who's not only a scholar but actually understands what you studied, which, you know, supposedly Barack Obama was a constitutional scholar as well. I suppose it would take an expert to try and destroy it as much as he has. But I thank you. And if you don't care, one more time, give us all those websites. If people want to help out, if people want to make donations, and you're actually still accepting contributions of time with legal experts too, if they don't have money but want to donate time clerking and that nature. Is that correct?
Absolutely, yes. We'd like to have attorneys and law clerks, anybody who can donate some time to us, to contact us at usjf.net. That's where people can go to make donations. That's where the veterans can go. You can also go to the About Michael Connelly Executive Director section on top. You can find a link to my website and blog where you can keep up with my blog articles and find out about all of the stuff that I have written. And you can also find out how to order that booklet, Our Constitution. So, you know, we do need for people to contact us. We will get back to you. It may take some time, a week or two if you're a veteran, but you will be contacted by me or my assistant. We'll get more information, and we will represent you without charge if you qualify for the situation.
All right, sir. Well, again, thank you very much for your time today. I appreciate you coming on. And, again, you have an open invitation, sir.
Thank you, Tim. Appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Bye. All right, ladies and gentlemen, that was the Executive Director of the United States Justice Foundation, Mr. Michael Connelly. And, again, I can't express to you how important this effort to protect our veterans is. He's on the front lines fighting this fight. And, again, if you'll check out his website and if you feel like it's worthwhile, I mean, I don't like to get on bandwagons on a regular basis, although lots of times it seems like I do. But, you know, this is a worthwhile project in my reckoning. I've made contributions myself, albeit relatively small ones, because, well, I'm in the same economy as the rest of you guys. But, excuse me, if there's any way that you guys can help out, please feel free. Check out the website, take a look. At the very least, you might be interested in following Michael's blog and things of that nature. I see that Lady Michelle has made it into the chat room, by the way, so welcome to the chat room, and thanks for being here today. Always appreciate everyone's participation. Mary's been holding down the chat room quite well to this point. Also had sent out an invitation for a guest, and I'm not sure, because I never got confirmation if he'd be able to make it or not. He's been very busy. One of the executive directors that created the Patriots Rally for Freedom that took place yesterday in Texas. If you listen to, not last week, but the week before, the last broadcast I did here, had some discussion about that rally. It took place yesterday. Had a very interesting group of people show up, was my understanding. I'm hopeful that maybe he still will be able to make that call in. We did our fair share of playing phone tag a little bit. If he can't be on, I certainly understand that, but if he calls in the next few minutes, we'll have him on. If not, we'll be moving right into the second hour where Danny Page will be on. And most of you guys who are regular listeners have heard Danny a few times at this point. Mr. Page is, of course, running for U.S. Senate right here in Tennessee. He's challenging for the same seat currently held by Lamar Alexander. He has an announcement that he's going to be making here. And I look forward to speaking to him in just a little bit. And we'll be talking about his campaign to this point, what has transpired, and like I said, he does have an announcement that he's making as well. In the meanwhile, I do want to point out again, you know, we briefly kind of touched on this idea of trying to pass a law to require the President of the United States to follow the law and the Constitution. The very fact that that would be necessary is ridiculous. But sadly, it is necessary. And I do wish it had managed to make its way into the Senate. And, you know, it's highly unlikely the Democrats, even with the political pressures of the upcoming midterm elections, would have allowed that to go to Obama's desk. What I would really like to have seen is if he had vetoed it, and to have him explain to that. Would like to have him on record explaining to the American people why he felt it necessary to veto a bill that simply says that he would follow the law. In the chat room, we've got a conversation going on about asking in regards to the Patriots Rally for Freedom and about attendance. I understand that the weather did turn rather nasty there, kind of cold, rainy, not particularly good for getting a large crowd, but I still understand that they had a pretty decent turnout for what they were expecting, just nowhere near the numbers they were hoping for. Really, I haven't gotten much in the way of communications back from them again. I was hoping to have a recap today. And if he doesn't make it, and again, like I said, we were phone tagging back and forth to send information, never got a confirmation. So certainly understand if he couldn't make it on. But hopefully at some point in the near future we can have him on and we'll discuss it and maybe find out what might be next on the agenda for this organization, because they're far from done. These folks are fighting back against Battleground Texas, which in essence is just, it's Acorn. You know, they've changed their name. They've done what they needed to do to try and stay one step ahead of those folks that have figured out what Acorn was about. But as the progressives have done, they change definitions. They change words. They change their name. The only way they can win the argument is by controlling the language, because they know they can't stand up and win an argument based on facts. So in this particular case, this, for all intents and purposes, is still Acorn, but they are Battleground Texas. And they are doing everything they can, not necessarily to get Wendy Davis elected governor this go-around. It has a lot more to do with trying to, over the course of the next 8 years, change Texas to a blue state. When you look at the numbers, and again, we talked about this a couple of weeks ago on air. When you look at the numbers, if Texas goes blue, and you look at the Electoral College, given the fact that New York and California are firmly blue, it would almost make it impossible for anyone from the Republican Party to win a presidential election again. So the effort to keep Texas from turning blue is an important one. And again, it's a fight that you wouldn't even think would have to be fought if you know very many people from Texas. One of the great things about broadcasting here and doing conservative talk radio is you meet so many great people from the state of Texas. You know that Texans are no nonsense, down to earth, we want freedom kind of people. If we lose the voting block of Texas through the conservative values, then the nation may very well be lost at that point. I mean, what chance do you have? Again, just talking off the top of my head here, but I can't possibly underestimate the importance of keeping Texas red. There's almost no way for the balance of power. Mary just posted in the chat room, she thinks that most of her Facebook friends are from Texas. And you know, it doesn't surprise me. And since the show has been growing in popularity, I still don't necessarily have those kind of live numbers that I would like to have, but the podcasts are really picking up, especially across all the other media boards. You can hear this show on Stitcher.com. You can hear us over at TuneIn.com. You can find us at iTunes. You know, and across all those boards, the number of weekly plays of the shows continues to get larger. And since that time frame, more and more of my Facebook friends and more of my connections on Twitter are coming up from Texas as well. Some of the best people I met over at TeaPartyCommunity.com, which, by the way, is a great social media website. If you haven't checked it out, I highly encourage that you do. But some of the best people I've met over there and actually gotten involved in conversations and, you know, really gotten to a point where I feel like I kind of know are all from Texas. And there's some great folks from a lot of other great states. I'm not knocking anybody. There are patriots all over the country, no question, no doubt. But what's most amazing to me is how many great Texans there are out there that is leading the charge to protect the Constitution and to protect individual liberty. What it all comes down to, though, is Texas is under assault because of how important it is. By population, by size, it's one of the biggest states. If Texas just becomes purple, it's scary for the cause of conservative values in this country. Texas may be the last vestige of freedom in the nation anyway. I know I've heard a lot of people talking about or who have moved to Texas specifically for that purpose. Lady Michelle in the chat room says that she's actually spoke to her son just the other day about moving to Texas. You know, you have links to your home, and you hate to – I mean, I would hate to leave Tennessee. I love to travel, love to visit. Have thoroughly enjoyed going to places. You know, I loved visiting New York City. Well, we stayed primarily in Manhattan. Loved it. Love traveling to Illinois. Love being in Chicago. It's a great town, and the people are friendly. Would not ever want to live in any of those locations. Because this is home to me. But if it came down to it, if Tennessee was to start shifting purple again and eventually end up blue, yeah, I'm afraid I probably would. And Texas would be the first place I'd want to go. So we've really got to get behind folks that are doing things like running the rally, the Patriots Rally for Freedom, the folks that are standing up against the so-called progressives and their agenda. These people see the Constitution as an obstacle for what they want. And again, you know, I know I've said this countless times, but a lot of the people helping to push this movement are just young, naive, well-meaning people. They just don't understand, partially because our education is not teaching them as it should, the values of individual liberty. Part of it is because so many people are controlled under the thumb of needing government assistance to the point that they're taught that there's no reason to be self-sufficient. It's tragic. We live in a nation that was built on rugged individualism, independence, personal responsibility. I got into an argument the other day on a conservative group over at Facebook. I had posted a link to one of the shows, and the guy was obviously a hardcore libertarian. And you know the differences. You know, and I certainly don't knock any libertarians. I lean libertarian in a lot of ways. I'm just not hardcore about it. And there's a few places where with the political party itself, I kind of disagree, like involving certain recreational drug use and you know, matters of foreign policy. Sometimes I think the libertarian approach is a bit short-sighted. this guy was hardcore, and he was like, oh, just conservatives. And he was substituting the word conservative for Republican in the debate, and I tried to make that distinction early, too. There are plenty of progressives in the Republican Party, and plenty of Republicans that even if they're not progressive, they certainly are not conservative. Despite that, this guy was just, conservatives are idiots and lazy and blah, blah, blah. And I'm thinking to myself, what is the deal? But at any rate, at one point he made the statement that personal responsibility is just a buzzword for Republicans to get excited about. And that's not the case. Because he was trying to make the argument about personal, about financial freedom. And, of course, you know, the Federal Reserve is an issue. The Federal Reserve, it needs to be audited and it needs to be dealt with, quite honestly. We're never going to have financial freedom in this country as long as the Federal Reserve exists, at least in its current form. But I tried to make the point that financial responsibility is the key to financial freedom, and that these are not just buzzwords. When Press Secretary Gibbs a few weeks back made the statement that freedom is just a buzzword, it infuriated me, and I think I was still kind of upset about hearing that when this guy says that individual responsibility is just a buzzword. And I could not get this guy to come around to the fact that, you know what, you're alienating a lot of folks that would agree with you on the issue of the Fed. You're alienating them by calling them names. You could try reaching out and, I don't know, maybe trying to enlighten some of those that are willing to listen. Because, you know, tell you for me, I know everybody listening to this show has felt the frustration of talking to somebody that just doesn't understand. They just don't get it. And you can sit there and you'll talk to them till you turn blue in the face, trying to get a simple point across that they're just unwilling to accept. I understand that frustration, and it does alienate a lot of folks. It does turn them bitter. That's why you hear so many angry people when it comes to talking about Common Core, when it comes to talking about the IRS scandal. You know, for the life of me, I still keep having flashbacks in this conversation with a friend of mine, someone I went to high school with, someone whose opinion I respect greatly. And I sent her an invitation to listen to the show when we were talking about how the IRS is still targeting the Tea Party. Some of the regular listeners probably remember that episode. It's been a little while back. But when we were broadcasting, you know, we were talking about it. I said, her response to me, though, was a, no, thank you, I don't agree with the Tea Party political agenda. I asked the simple question then and there. It's like, regardless of where you're at on the political spectrum, you can't tell me you support the IRS targeting anyone because of political beliefs, do you? Ultimately, this is where I keep coming back to. I keep trying to have these conversations with folks about what extent do we want to have our government to have power and authority? How much do we really want to ignore the Constitution? And it keeps coming back to the simple argument, and again, for the regulars, and I love you guys, please forgive me, because I know you've heard this before. If you like Barack Obama having executive orders out the wazoo authority, you're okay with that. Let me ask you, how would you feel if in another couple of years that was Ted Cruz that had that same authority? Would that be okay with you? Were you okay with George W. Bush having executive authority to write these titles? And if you are you okay with Barack having it? If the answer to either one of those is no, then the answer for all of it should be no. Now, I'm going to take a quick break right now, and when we come back, we'll be talking to Mr. Danny Page, so stay with me.
Tap into the truth. Listen in live every Sunday at 3 p.m. Check us out at tapintothetruth.com for our latest blog posts and for links to all of our past broadcasts. Don't forget to like us on Facebook and to follow us on Twitter. That's Tap Into the Truth every Sunday at 3 p.m.
Yes, that's right, ladies and gentlemen. Right here on Blog Talk, 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, we do get started. And with me now is Mr. Danny Page. How are you today?
I'm good, Tim. I'm doing very well, and I appreciate you having me.
Well, you know, I've told you before and that you have an open invitation at any point in time. I certainly meant it. I enjoy our conversations. I enjoy the fact that you obviously, you know, you felt faith-led into entering this race, and that much has been made very clear. All anybody has to do is listen to what you have to say. You can feel the sincerity, and I appreciate the fact that you followed your faith and that you're trying to step up and make things better, not only for the folks here in Tennessee, but also across the country as a whole. Now, last time you were here, we were talking about the campaign. What are your new developments? How's the campaign been going?
Campaign's been going rather good, steady. We are doing as well as expected at this time. We're crisscrossing the state. Been going to a lot of small towns, you know, every day. Tennessee, you know, just a lot of rural communities and county seats, going across the town squares, door to door, local businesses, meeting the local folks in these little towns here and there. And I was in Brownsville early last week, and one lady that owns a little market, little restaurant there, she said, "I believe you're probably the only U.S. Senate candidate to ever come to Brownsville, Tennessee." And, of course, I have no idea if that's true or not, but you know, it really hits home with the people when you're out there in the streets knocking on the doors and meeting them on the sidewalks and asking them, how's your business, how's your personal economy, how's your family doing? And they're making the connection, and that's just who I am. And I can't fathom these so-called leaders that we have not doing this, but they're AWOL. They're not showing up. The only events they're going to are fundraising events, and those are the things that I just don't have any interest in. I just want to get out there and see how things are going for my fellow Tennesseans. You know, I live here in the Nashville area, and we've been in a little bit of an economic bubble, and that things are better in Nashville than they are in other parts of the state. So I want to get out there and talk to the voters and say, what's going on out here? How do you feel? And what's on your mind and what's on your heart? And let me share with you this message and vision that I have. And people are really connecting with the fact that they can sense the sincerity in what I say and how I present myself, and the fact that I am a blue-collar guy, I'm a working-class individual, and I'm a family man, and that I'm guided by my faith. And I really think that Tennesseans are sick of politicians.
You know, I got to tell you, I don't think it's just Tennesseans. I think the country as a whole is just, we're beyond this professional politician. I'm getting into this because this is a career choice. One of my favorite East Tennessee politicians that I've supported for quite a while, Mr. Zach Womp, he's been in it for quite a while, and now he has a son that's trying to get into politics as well. He's making a second attempt himself. And it was really part of seeing Zach's son, Weston, come into politics the way he did, and he almost expected to cakewalk into a seat. And a lot of that really helped to drive home to me the fact that it really seems like we have moved to a political aristocracy as opposed to a representative republic like we're supposed to have.
Correct.
But this whole political, professional, this is going to be my career thing, we've really got to put an end to that. It's ridiculous. We need a return to the days of the citizen politician, the folks that would go and serve because they felt led to, because their neighbors called on them to do it. They would go, they would serve, and then they were in a hurry to get back so that they could get back to their lives, their everyday message, and just, you know, be done with it. Take their turn and do it. We need more of that. As far as fundraising goes, you did kind of mention fundraising. How is the fundraising going for your campaign?
I'll be honest with you, it's slow. It's a trickle-down effect. I'll say this. We've had every dollar that we've needed to have, but if people are looking at money, then they're not going to find it in our campaign right now. All the Republican money is going to Lamar and to another candidate. The Republican establishment, the Republican donors, the Republican Party is putting all their money into two baskets. They're going to buy the election with one of those guys, so they think, and I understand that. And we feel like the water table is going to change here real soon, and our well's going to fill up. We got a lot of people looking our way, but I'm really not focused too hard. There was a time early in the campaign I thought, I got to do this. This is what everybody's telling me I have to do. And I went after it, and I really felt like I was wasting energy and time going down that path, when the best thing I can do is get in front of people, tell them who I am, what I'm about, and hear their pleads. And when I do that, then everyday people open up their pocketbook and their wallet and say, how can I help? And it's small. It's not, you know, these giant contributions that are coming from big business or big donors. But like I said, every need has been met so far, and I'm okay with that. And, you know, everybody else would look and say, this isn't possible, and that's fine. But, again, I'm guided by my faith, and I've said from the beginning that I didn't get into this race because it was something I wanted to do. This race came looking for me. God called me to it. And if it's his will, it's his bill. And so far, he's foot the bill pretty well. And, you know, my banker isn't wondering how to invest the money that we're depositing into this campaign account by any means. But, we have every need we've had so far. God's put somebody there to write a check. And so that's all I'm concerned about, really.
Well, you're kind of hinting a little bit with what you're saying about the Republican Party. You do have an announcement to make. Would you like to go ahead and make that announcement?
I would, Tim, and I appreciate this. You've been kind to me and my campaign, and let me make my calls and share with your audience my heart, so I wanted to share this first on your show, and I thank you for giving me this time to do this today. When I got into this race, being a Christian conservative, my natural tendency was to run as a Republican. That's typically how I vote. Not all the time, but typically how I vote. It seems like the past few elections it has been 100%, but, you know, I try to judge the person and not just by what initials by their name. But we got into this race as a Republican. I was seeking the primary seat, and what I discovered pretty quick was that the main party establishment is for Lamar no matter what. There is nothing Lamar can do that will keep these people from fundraising for him, from endorsing him. Now, what they do in the ballot box, who knows? And then, of course, there was another candidate. I know you've had him on your show, and he's a big GOP guy. He fundraises for the GOP. He has sworn his allegiance to the GOP, and he's not going away. And in Tennessee, what we have is a system where if you have more than one conservative in the race, you mentioned Zach Womp, he's a good example of that. If you have more than one conservative in the race or a couple of people that the public perceive as conservatives, then they split the vote, and the moderate or the rhino or the progressive wins the primary because of Democrat crossover votes in the primary and things of that nature, people just showing up and, oh, I know Lamar's name, I cast a vote, I don't know these other two people. Like Zach Womp, Ron Ramsey, Bill Haslam ran for governor last cycle, or 4 years ago. Ron Ramsey presented himself as a conservative, Zach Womp is seen as a conservative, Bill Haslam was the new guy, the moderate, and Bill became governor winning less than 50% of the primary vote. Had Zach not been in, Ramsey may have won. Had Ramsey not been in, Zach definitely would have won. So I've had that on my mind for the past 6 or 7 months that is this what we want to do? And I gave my word early on to some groups that were vetting me and other candidates. I said, I'm not going to be the one to split the vote. I will not be bouncing my grandkids on my knee one day and then say, Granddad, did you really split the vote and let Lamar Alexander win a third term? Do a, you know, a cakewalk when he should have been beat. I'm not going to be that guy. And as I began praying through this, searching through this, my heart led me to run as an independent. It doesn't change who I am. If anything, it really speaks more to who I am. And so those that choose to, and there's three or four that are in the primary race for the Republican Party, they can battle it out. They can spend that hard-earned money that Tennesseans have donated to them and fight it out with TV ads and radio commercials and media, this and that. And I have my opinion on how that's going to turn out. And then on August 8th, the day after the primary, I'm going to be standing there as a conservative, a true conservative, against whoever's left. And I believe Lamar Alexander's going to win that primary because I don't believe the other couple of candidates in the race are that much different than him. And so his name recognition is going to win out in that case. So that's why we've made the move. When I say we, I mean my campaign team. There was a lot of thought and prayer and bouncing things back and forth. Is this really what we want to do? And we all felt that this was what we have to do. And, you know, people get a shot at Lamar in the primary if they want to go vote in the Republican primary, and they can take a shot and they might knock him off. Or they'll have a second shot in that general election. And I believe that we are the path to victory in November running as an independent.
All right. Well, I know you had actually told me this a little while back, just as full disclosure to the listeners. And I got to tell you,
yes,
it was really hard for me to kind of keep that to myself. But you asked me to, and I told you I would. It's big news, and anytime there's big news, it's a natural implication, especially for somebody that does a show like this, to just get out there and blab it everywhere. So I want you to fully appreciate how hard that was for me. But, you know, I do understand, you know, I mentioned this back and forth when you first told me a little bit. Part of me wishes that you would stay in the race because I really want to see our party, and when I say our party, of course, I'm referring to the Republicans, taken back by true conservatives who are firmly planted in religious understanding but still believes in the Constitution and understanding that I'll be led by my faith, but I won't let my faith push me to discriminate against another person. And you, to me, sir, you embody all that. We've had a few conversations back and forth since I first contacted you, and I have never got to talk to you as much as I'd like to. But I feel like I know you a little bit, certainly a little bit better than the other folks I've had come on, and I really like you personally, and I hope that that shows through easily enough. But I felt like during the conversation, you have prayed on this. You do feel like this is where you're leading, and I told you before that I kind of agree with you that this is the best way for you to honor the promises you made and still follow your path. So I do commend you on following through, and I mentioned it before too. It is so hard to run an independent campaign.
Right.
And it to me, that shows a tremendous amount of courage, because you are there not just to send the message, but you're trying to win too. You know, this isn't just about just get the message out there. And I've known people that have run for offices before just hoping to impact the discussion. There is a real
right.
message there. And,
right. I'm not in this just to impact the discussion. I am in this to win this. I do want to impact the discussion. I want to impact the discussion nationally. But I believe the best way to do that is to win. And they can say, who is this guy that Tennessee elected? You know, that's going to be national news. And I'll have a pulpit nationally to share this movement, this ballot box revolution is turning the page on politics. And so we're going after it. And I do appreciate you keeping that under wraps. We shared that with you just because you've been so sincere towards me in a campaign that I wanted to let you know what was going on. And we wrestled with it. I mean, my committee met several times, and when I first brought it up that I felt like this may be the way that that the Lord is leading me, I had some people on my campaign team that, you know, they were like, no, I don't know about all that. They had the same reservations that you have, the same reservations that I have. You know, you're like, I just have to run as a Republican. I just got to try to find a way to win that primary, regardless of the splitting of the votes and all that. But as we begin to pray through it, every one of us, I mean pray through it, not just say we prayed, we all came back and said, you know what, this is the right way to do this. And even though I was running as a Republican, I was really running an independent campaign because the party didn't want to have anything to do with me. And so I was kind of out there by myself anyway. I got a phone call one day from the party wanting me to donate, and I laughed. I said, well, if I write you a check, how much are you going to write to my campaign? And they just didn't know what to do with that. So
right.
I said, you know, the well's dry on this end, boys. I'm not writing you a check. But in one thing, we started talking about this before Christmas, and we thought we might make the announcement before we have, but we just wanted to be sure, because once you make that jump, you've made that jump. There's no going back.
Right.
And, you know, so there was a lot of back and forth, but what we did not foresee coming was the statistic that came out probably a month or so ago, that 25% of people who identify themselves as Republicans, who voted Republican last cycle, now see themselves as independents. And that's what I'm seeing when I go door to door, you know, in Columbia or Gainesboro or Brownsville or Manchester, you know, all over the states. That's what I'm finding. People say, you know what, the party has left me. The party does not stand for the things that I stand for, and I'm tired of holding my nose, voting for the lesser of two evils, and hoping that the new guy that we elect, that we promote from a city or a county or a state office, I hope he does better than Lamar does. People are sick and tired of it. We've got to give people a reason to show up and vote. And right now, they're not finding that in any of the party people. There's several people that's going to be on this ballot, Tim. I think it may be close to 15 when you count Democrats, Independents, Libertarians, and Republicans. But people want to be able to get behind somebody, and the Republican Party has gave us two people that we're running from. We're running from Lamar, and, you know, I'll just say it, and people don't want anything to do with Joe Carr. So, but I'm not running against Joe Carr. I'm running against whoever wins that primary, and I honestly believe it's going to be Lamar Alexander. But I want to give people something to show up and vote for in November. We've got four constitutional amendments that's going to be on the ballot in November. And amendment number one is very important to me. It's very important to Christians in general, and I think to most people, really. The Yes on One Amendment, the Pro-Life Amendment that changes some wording in our Constitution, because right now Tennessee is an abortion destination. We have no laws on the book in Tennessee against abortion, and every state that borders us sends people here to get their abortions, and whether you think abortion is okay or not, certainly you don't want to be the go-to place for that. I don't think anybody wants to be the go-to place. Look what's happening down the street from my house. And we need to be better than that, and we can shore that up a little bit. But people are going to have a reason to come out and vote, and I want to be part of that reason. And so, we're marching along with this ballot box revolution, as we call it, and hoping to make an impact. We're doing it one county at a time, one little town at a time, one Facebook post at a time. People are, I live up here in Robertson County, and last weekend I was given the opportunity to speak to the Robertson County Republican Party, and I knew a few people in the room, and I got a chance to speak, and people came to me afterwards and said, "We had no idea you were in this race. We were going to be voting against Lamar. Now we have somebody to vote for." And, that encourages me.
Well, that's definitely the kind of thing you want to hear as a candidate.
Right,
That, that sends the strong message that folks like what they're hearing. And like I said, people that listen to you, they get the sincerity. They understand that you mean what you're saying. You get a lot of these polished answers. And as my role as host of the show, especially during the political season when it's a political show, I really try not to pick sides or be too negative towards any of the candidates that are willing to come on and talk. I consider it a favor to them so much as I let them come on and get their message out. But it's also a favor to me as a guest to come on and give me somebody to talk to, and kind of helps legitimize me as a host and all that wonderful stuff. But I fully understand what you're saying. Joe Carr, when he was on, presented himself like somebody that didn't have a serious challenger. This race was just him and Lamar, and whichever one duked that out would be the next senator from the state of Tennessee. And that mentality, I asked him directly, "Were you concerned about all the people that were jumping into this race?" And his response was that there are no other candidates.
I heard that.
I have nothing against confidence, but there is a difference between confidence and arrogance, and I think I'm about to creeping up towards the arrogance part. And, I like Joe Carr's politics. But, that level of sincerity doesn't come out. And you feel that with you. And that's part of why I have been as supportive as I have been. And I certainly like the idea. But, Mary in the chat room jokingly just a few minutes ago said that maybe you should run as a Democrat, since Democrats run as Republicans all the time. But then she points out the fact that independent candidates often have a hard time getting votes. Do you have a plan in place other than just their door-to-door to really get out your vote? I mean, you were talking about giving people a reason to get out there. Do you have a strategy in mind, or is it still just more of the going out door to door?
Well, it's definitely grassroots. It's definitely door to door. I'm not going to abandon that. It's definitely web driven and social media. But you know, one of the biggest things that's going to happen, Tim, is on August 8th when people wake up and realize, because here's what they say: if you win the Republican primary, you are the senator, because typically whoever wins that primary goes on and wins the general election. But on August 8th, people are going to realize, you know what, we do have an opportunity to beat Lamar Alexander, and all these groups and all that money that was wanting to beat Lamar and getting behind Joe Carr are going to
Danny,
say,
are you there?
Can you hear me? Tim?
Well, I've still got him on the line, but I think we have lost him.
Tim, can you hear me?
Lost the audio.
Can
I hate
for
that
Tim?
To happen in mid-sentence, too, because he's about to make
can
a very important
me,
point.
Hello, Tim?
If you can still hear me, Danny, you might want to hang up and call back in, because we're not getting any audio from you right now. We'll get you right back on if you want to go ahead and call us back. But in the meanwhile, I mean, it's an important issue as far as trying to get votes as an independent. And I think
yep.
we've got you back. Are you there? Okay, there we
can
go.
Can you hear me? All right, I
can hear you.
Hear you
now.
You couldn't hear me. Yeah. Okay. So you know, we're not going to abandon the game plan that we have, but like I said, people are going to wake up on August 8th and say, in a typical year, Lamar Alexander has won again. But this is not a typical year. The guy that, and let me make this clear, Joe goes around the state and the Beat Lamar team goes around the state and says that Joe has 100% of the Tea Party coalition behind him. I know that not to be a fact, but that's what he says. And he
right.
sways
well, you
people
know, it,
with that comment. But on August 8th, what are Tea Party people going to do? Are they going
right.
to throw up their hands and go away? Or are they going to say, you know what, we can get behind this other guy. We didn't get behind him early because he didn't have any money in the bank. But guess what? The guy with the money in the bank isn't here anymore. And we've got somebody that we really believe in, a guy that we said with our own mouth, our own testimony, was this is the guy with integrity, and now we can vote for him and get behind him. I have an open invitation from Club for Growth, from Family Research Council, from Generation Joshua, and from Freedom March to go to Washington to go through their process. They've done the background info on me to go to Washington and do that. And receive the benefits of being an endorsed candidate. And people say, well, why haven't you done that yet? Well, some of those were not going to get behind anybody until after the primary, and
right.
it costs money to go to Washington and do those things. So I've been using the funds that we have just to make an impact out here on the street, because as I've been told by Freedom March, sometimes we endorse early and sometimes we endorse late. And if you're somebody we want to endorse, we'll make it happen when we need to make it happen. But so I have that in my wheelhouse. Joe Carr doesn't have that. They've already denied him. You know, you mentioned Joe Carr's politics and things. And if we look at if his voting record and Lamar's voting record, they're not very stellar and they're not conservative. But he's placed himself in a position of an opportunity, and people think he is. And he made that comment on your show that he wasn't concerned. There are no other people in the race. And I understand that arrogance. Twice he has denied debates with me that were organized by Tea Party groups. The very groups that he say 100% supports him, they've said, okay, you debate Danny. We'll shut Danny down that way, and he won't even do that. But that he says that we're not here, that we're not in the race, whatever. But believe me, he's got his people. I believe some people call them internet trolls, and they are constantly sending me messages, harassing me on Twitter and Facebook. Why don't I get out of this race? Because I'm blowing it for Joe. So he can say what he wants to on his show, but behind the scenes, they're all but begging me to get out. And we were trying to pressure him out, and he didn't, so we made our move.
Well, I guess they don't have a reason to target you anymore, at least until the general election comes in. One of the things that I was looking at, too, is you sent me a list of some of your press releases just a little while before the show, and I was looking at them. I was wondering if you wouldn't care to kind of go over some of your grievances against Lamar Alexander, because if you're outside of the state, you probably don't know as much about Lamar as you do if you're in the state. The same thing as the folks over, you know, you want to look at people like Lindsey Graham. You want to look at other folks like Senator McCain. You know, we have folks that make national headlines, and then maybe that's all you know. But these are important reasons why Lamar Alexander is very, very vulnerable. Yeah, that would be the word.
Very vulnerable.
Words on the tip of your tongue. But folks maybe don't understand why. Would you care to go over some of those grievances, especially the ones in that you think are the biggest game changers?
Absolutely. And thank you for that segue. You know, we go out on the campaign trail, and whether it's me or a handful of other candidates, we throw that statistic out there that Lamar votes with the Obama agenda 62% of the time. I knocked on a door down in West Tennessee one day and talked to the lady, and she said, "Well, who are you running against?" And I said, "Lamar Alexander." She said, "Oh, no, 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 I like Lamar. He's my friend. He does us right." And I said, "Well, I'll tell you what, if you check out my website and you read some of the articles on there and some of the statistics on there, and if you don't like me, then you go vote for Lamar. But I believe that you'll change your mind when you see my website." And here's the thing with Lamar. Lindsey Graham is in trouble in South Carolina. They have a runoff situation there. They're running about three Tea Party people against him. Lindsey Graham is going to get beat in South Carolina. It's going to be another Ted Cruz deal where he wins the runoff deal. Mitch McConnell is going to get beat in Kentucky. Matt Bevin is going to beat him. And the big groups are 100% behind him, and they're going to make that happen. Several of these senators that have been around a long time are going to get beat. And what's that going to do? Lamar could end up being the majority leader in the Senate if he is not beaten. If Lamar gets reelected and all these other guys fall, he could end up being the majority leader. And Tennesseans may say, "Oh, well, that makes us proud because our senator, if you look at his voting record, it will be more of the, it'll actually be worse than Mitch McConnell being the majority leader, because Mitch McConnell has a conservative voting record. It's not near as conservative as it could be, don't get me wrong. But if they're going to take in a class, McConnell passes, Lamar fails based on his record. And so in the spirit of our forefathers, we kind of made a declaration of independence. We don't have to be tied to a party. We need to understand. George Washington warned us about this, and I'll be posting some of his words. But if in the bottom of the Declaration of Independence, they're talking about the king and the tyranny that he had brought upon the colonies, and they had a list of 17 grievances against the king. So in the spirit of that, I just took out 25 things that Lamar has voted on in the past 6 or 7 years, and I feel like that are grievances against Tennesseans. He touts himself as being a guy that's pro-military. I talk to veterans and I talk to enlistees today. Lamar's not their friend and they know it. He recently voted for cloture, which allowed a vote to cut their pensions, cut their disability. That's not a friend of the military. He voted to send them to Afghanistan, to send them to Iraq, and to send them on multiple deployments 18 months, come home for a couple months, go back for 18 months. His votes help make those things happen. Then they come back maimed, permanently disabled, loss of limbs, brain damage, and then cuts their disabilities. That's not a friend of the military. He voted no against allowing TRICARE to pay for autism. So if I'm in the military offering my life for the family, for your freedom, and I have a child with autism, my health care coverage does not pay for my child, and Lamar voted against that, what kind of guy is that? He voted against the F-22 Raptor program after we had all that money tied up in it, and he decides we're going to cut the spending on it right at the end of the game plan. He says he's pro-life, but he voted against prohibiting federally funded abortion services. So Lamar wants to take money from me and you, Tim, and let the feds dish it out to places like Planned Parenthood, who we know are lining up young girls, a lot of inner-city kids, for abortions. I have to pay for that. You have to pay for that. Lamar had a chance to say no. He didn't say no. And some of these things, he could have said no, and they still would have passed. So that just shows me where his heart is. He wanted to be part of the majority in saying yes. He said no against making food labels specify whether they have genetically modified organisms. You know, the whole movement. My family, you know, we're not hippies or anything by that of any means, but we buy a lot of fresh, organic-type foods. My wife shops in an Amish community, and we get a lot of our foods from there. I want to know what's in my food, and then I want to make a choice whether I want to eat it or not. Do I always eat right? No, I don't. But he's against, he didn't want that to be on the labels. He voted for the Patriot Act and the reauthorization of the Patriot Act. And I know when the Patriot Act was first passed, that was days after 9/11, and pretty much the whole country was on board. But when we found out what was in it, we begin to decide we don't like the Patriot Act. And instead of reevaluating it, he was a yes vote the second time around. He has voted multiple times on the FISA amendments, and we have found out because of Edward Snowden that they are spying on us. They are probably listening to these phone conversations now, Tim. We know all the things that have come out in the past 6 months about the FISA courts and the NSA spying. Lamar repeatedly has authorized that. He voted against letting legal carry permit holders take their guns into national parks. Now, a lot of us have a gripe about having to go get a permit anyway and keeping that permit, you know, active every couple of years and paying the money and the background checks. But those of us that are doing that, he says, no, you can't carry that in the park. I thought he was pro-gun. He voted against the Buy American clause. So, you know, we saw, remember in the Olympics a couple of years ago, in the Summer Olympics, where we had all of our athletes, their clothing was from another country?
Yeah.
Because he voted no on that. And before, they would have had to Buy American. I mean, he voted yes for cash for clunkers. He voted no to audit the Fed. I believe that's probably a big thing that your listeners are for, auditing the Fed, ending the Fed. He voted no on auditing the Fed. He voted yes on ethanol subsidies. He voted no on the cut, cap, and balance. And he voted yes to earmarks. This guy is a big spender, anti-military. And when he's a big-time liberty-crushing individual. He is a progressive in a plaid shirt. And this list of grievances on my website will spell that out. I've got the dates of the votes, the bill numbers, the amendment numbers. He can't hide from these things. I did hours and hours of study on this. And this, and I've only went back, you know, to maybe 2007. There's another whole term before that. The writing is on the wall. Lamar Alexander has failed as our senator, and we certainly do not want to position him to be the majority leader because it'll be more of the same. I was in a room last weekend. He sent one of his staffers to speak for him, and that poor young man, I believe if they'd have had tar and feather, he'd have come out looking like a chicken because they skinned him alive. And he denied the whole 62% of the time number. He denied that by saying, he said, well, Lamar, he said, Barack Obama's not even a senator. We don't vote with him. He's the president. I'm like, really, that's going to be your line? The purpose is he's voting the Obama agenda. He's voting the progressive agenda 62% of the time. And so I don't know if that young man really believed that or if he's just foolish. But there are grievances, and I believe if people read them, then they'll say, Lamar's not the right guy for this job.
I think most people would if they understand it. But, again, you know, it's a case where so many people don't know what the voting records are. You know,
right.
Lamar, I've heard it said before. I think we may have even discussed it. There's more people in Tennessee that know Lamar Alexander than know God.
Right.
And,
right.
And he's had such a long and he's got a very good resume. He's done a lot of stuff. He's been in public service for a long time. And while I, on the one hand, respect his commitment to the state of Tennessee, I firmly disagree with a lot of his politics, especially what has popped up during the course of the second half of his first term in the Senate. He has went more and more towards a big government, progressive type of ideology, and he's ignored the constituency here in Tennessee. He's done a lot of what happened with Al Gore, I'm afraid, where, you know, Al Gore had spent so very little time in the state of Tennessee before he ran for president that it was almost obscene for him to claim to be a Tennessean. He still held property out outside of Nashville, but
yeah.
He didn't live there. He hadn't lived here in decades, and he was so out of touch with what Tennesseans need and want, he couldn't understand why he couldn't win his home state. I think Lamar's heading in that same direction. I do think that he's got a lot of people that are going to keep voting for him right now just based on name recognition alone because nobody knows about that. They don't pay attention to the voting record. So that's the number one thing that all the candidates need to do to help educate the public. But
that's right, and he has the mainstream media helping him out. The Tennessean has endorsed Lamar Alexander. He's their token Republican that they endorse. So you're not going to get a lot of stuff through the Tennessean. And, of course, the Tennessean owns half or more of the newspapers in the state. So you're not going to get a whole lot of action from them talking about his record. We're just going to have to get out there and get it done the old-fashioned way and beat the bushes and teach people and educate people. And, the message that I have is for Christians to wake up and take this country back. The church has put themselves in a position to think that we don't do government. We don't serve in government. Christians don't serve in government. That's for somebody else. Well, if you want to keep the republic that Ben Franklin and these other guys, Madison and Adams and Washington and all these other guys gave us, then you better serve in government because we can't have a nation of morals if we're not led by people with morals. We know good and well that Barack Obama and his folks he surrounds himself with, they're not going to do anything morally. And we are headed down a path to absolute collapse and ruin. And I just hope, Tim, that we can get to the November elections before this whole thing falls apart because it seems like we're teetering on disaster. Every other week something comes out. And I just pray that we can get to November and make some changes that put us in a positive mood for a while.
Well, before let me change the conversation a little bit here for a second. I had asked Mr. Conley in the first half of the show this question, and since you are running for Senate, I wanted your opinion too. This past week, we've seen an effort to pass legislation to force the person currently occupying the office of the President of the United States to actually follow the law and the Constitution. I just want your take on that whole situation.
Well, here's the way I look at the presidency, Tim, and until somebody can tell me I'm wrong, that's the way I'll continue to look at it. Let's say you've got a corporation with stockholders, shareholders, and they elect a president to serve that corporation. He's supposed to carry out their will. Okay? Barack Obama is not carrying out our will, and several other presidents before him didn't carry out our will. And our will is law. We are a country, a nation of laws. And we already have a way to discipline him, and it's called impeachment. But we don't have a will. The Republicans have a majority in the House. They can impeach him tomorrow. They can get it done tomorrow. They don't have a will. And that's part of what I've seen is the Republican Party is going in the same direction as the Democrat Party. Newt Gingrich and the boys would have already impeached this guy. Now, will that cause social unrest? Maybe it will. Will the Senate actually remove him? Absolutely not, as long as Harry Reid's in charge. But they'll go out and make a statement, and there'll have to be a discussion. When impeachment charges were brought against Bill Clinton, the media was forced to talk about it. Did they make Newt Gingrich and the guys look like the bad guys? Sure they did, but the discussion had to be had. So our forefathers gave us the way to correct the president. They can sue him today. They can impeach him today. They don't have the will to do it. Now, we got a few guys. Rand Paul's suing him. Trey Gowdy's going after him. Scott Desjarlais's going after him. A few guys. But a lot of it's a dog and pony show. So that law, that law of that they passed the other day or tried to pass or whatever, it's never going to see the light of day in the Senate anyway. It's a dog and pony show. Just like this, my congressman, Diane Black, I think she was one of the sponsors of the No Budget, No Pay Act. So if we don't pass a budget, then we won't get paid. Well, that was, like that was really going to go anywhere. If they won't pass a budget, they certainly ain't going to pass a law that will cut their pay or prevent them from getting paid. And right. Lamar voted against that, by the way, the No Budget, No Pay Act. I won't pass the budget, and I certainly will not pay myself. But, yeah, we already have a way. It's called impeachment, and this guy, what Bill Clinton did was just, it was disgusting. It was awful. It was, you know, sexual harassment. But it doesn't come close to measuring up to what this guy's doing to our country and just total lawlessness. And yeah. if they had the will, they could impeach him tomorrow, but they don't.
You know, basically my take on it, too, was this was mostly for political theater. But the one thing that it did do is it exposed some of the ignorance of some of the Democratic senators when they had their opportunity to talk on the floor. Certain folks from the Democratic Party in the state of Texas that I won't name specifically, but if anyone was paying attention, you already know. She's not exactly known for making intelligent arguments anyway. But
400 years.
But, yeah, it still seemed like it's still an opportunity for us to get that discussion. And we got Barack Obama on record admitting that if that law came to his office to be signed, if it did somehow magically pass the Senate, if there were enough Democrats in the Senate scared of this midterm election cycle that they actually passed this, because, first of all, who was to go on the record as saying No, I don't think the president should have to obey the law. That's kind of a tenuous position to defend while you're on the campaign trail. So if it was magically there, we got Barack Obama on the record saying that I would veto that. So
right.
I think some positive jabs for campaigning took place, but I'm afraid that's really all that was. I know there are some folks in the House and the Senate that are both so frustrated that the House won't do what it needs to do, which is impeachment. But the one thing they keep ignoring is if they did go ahead and impeach him, sure, maybe they never would get a conviction in the Senate for the impeachment, but they would have a whole new level of investigative authority, and they could get to the bottom of who actually gave the order to start targeting the Tea Parties by the IRS. They could get to the bottom of who gave the order to stand down during Benghazi. They could get to the truth of a lot of things that have been hidden. How much did Barack Obama actually know about Fast and Furious beforehand? Because nobody has pushed the issue about how he can use executive privilege to protect Eric Holder in the investigations that have taken place to this point if Obama was telling the truth about the first time hearing about it was during a press conference where someone asked a question. Obviously, there was no executive privilege to protect if he didn't know about it. So I would love to just see the impeachment process begin just to get that started. But you're right. The will isn't there. There's just a small handful of folks that want to make a positive change. And right now they're just way too far outnumbered, which is why we need to send people of conscience and consequence that believe in the Constitution during this midterm cycle to help give support to those people that are already leading the charge and to try to make something positive happen.
Right, and like you said, there are a few, there are a handful that are going after him. I applaud Congressman Scott Desjarlais. He is the only member of our delegation that has done what he said he would do. He is going after him. He's on that committee with Trey Gowdy. They're getting as far as they can go. We need an independent counsel, somebody that can look into this and take it to that next level. But guess what? The party's going after Desjarlais, the one guy that actually stands on the party platform and isn't a hypocrite, is the one guy the party's going to go after for something that he did a decade ago. And they're not worried about the way their people are voting last week. Now, had that seen the light of day in the Senate, my guess is that Lamar would have voted for it because it's an election year, and Corker would have voted against it. They usually kind of cancel each other out depending on who's up for re-election. That's just my opinion, and it kind of has to last because it's just the mess we're in. But, it's dog and pony show, man. It's election year politics.
Just one more reason to get rid of career politicians and getting our gentlemen farmers that they used to be at one point in time. Still makes for a pretty good analogy. We need to get back to folks that are going to go, that are going to serve, and then go back home.
I ran into a young lady that worked in a record shop on the square in Columbia, Tennessee, a couple of weeks ago, just going door-to-door talking. And she was just so surprised to see that I was running for Senate. And, I was dressed casually, had some nice jeans on, a Wrangler shirt on. And she's like, you're running for office? You're running for United States Senate? And I'm like, yes, ma'am. And began to go over some things with her. And she said, there's this local guy that comes in here, and he never wants to talk to me. He only wants to talk to the boss, which told me he's probably looking for a donation. But because she's just as much a voter as the boss is. But she said he comes in here dressed to the nines and, looking the part. She said, I'm not voting for that guy, and I could care less what he's peddling or what he's pushing. I may agree with everything he says, but it's the way he acts and the way he comes across. And she's the only part of that. And I run into that everywhere I go. And change is in the air, and, you know, Barack Obama just about ruined that word change for us. He just about ruined the word hope for us. But, you know, hope is a Christian word, and he can't take that away from me. And
right.
We're going to show Tennessee that it's time for change. It's okay to make a change. I believe Tennessee, you know, Tennessee is a right to work state. I believe that Tennessee is a right to vote state. People do not have to vote Democrat or Republican. They can vote independent. They can vote third party if they want to. If you find a candidate who lines up with your biblical or your beliefs and principles and values, vote for that candidate. Support that candidate. Tell your neighbors about that candidate. Don't let the little initial by the name mean anything. You know, the Democrat Party, the Republican Party, all they are is giant unions. And Tennessee is kind of not so union-friendly. And I know some of your listeners may be, and some of my supporters are. But as a state, as a whole, we're right to work, so we should be right to vote. The parties are giant unions. They're conglomerations of people that are peddling a message, and they want your money. And they're looking out for themselves and not for their constituents.
Well, another important thing to remember, especially for the folks that think you have to be in one party or the other, is this nation was founded basically with a two-party system. But it wasn't always the Democrats and the Republicans. In fact, both those parties came along after. And,
right.
You know, that means that there was somebody else there before, and they failed to serve their constituents left them behind the way they felt they had been left. Well, as much as I hate to, Mr. Page, time is winding down here for the show, so we're going to have to kind of cut it short. So one more time, if you want to tell everybody those websites where they can find your information and get all that wonderful campaign stuff together.
Please check out our website, DannyPage4Senate.com or Page, P-A-G-E, 4TN.com. Find us on Facebook. We have one of those like pages, and I have a regular Facebook page. It's Facebook.com/DannyPageForSenate. Like us on Facebook. Friend me on Facebook. If you're on Twitter, it's @Page4TN. Message me on Twitter or Facebook or on the website. Email me. There's an email address on the website. There's a phone number on the website. Call me. That'll ring straight to my cell phone. It's not my cell phone number, but it'll forward to my cell phone. Call me. I'll be glad to talk to you. If you would like to meet me, if you would like me to come and to talk to a group in your area, meet in your living room with your neighbors, I will do that. I'm not above Tennesseans. I'm not afraid. I'll answer your questions. I am transparent. But DannyPage4Senate.com, go check that out. Find this list of grievances. Share it on Facebook. I've got a declaration of independence saying why I'm running as an independent. And go and check it out. Go and find out what I'm all about more than these radio interviews. And I really appreciate these interviews. And this time, Tim, I really do, and I do need to get up your way and sit down and have a meal together and meet each other's families. And so maybe we can do that here coming up.
I would definitely enjoy that.
Appreciate the time today, sir.
I appreciate you coming down the show, and I appreciate having the opportunity to be the first official place you made your announcement. And just FYI, Mary in the chat room wanted me to tell you specifically that you made a positive impression on her. So I think, once again, that sincerity has shown through, and maybe there's reason to believe in the future for independent candidates making their way. At any rate,
Mary,
I'm certainly gonna say
to Mary, reach out to me on the web, on Facebook or something. Reach out to me. I want to talk to you.
All right. Well, again, I'm going to have to go ahead and end everything right here, but thank you again, and you've got to come back and continue to give us updates about the campaign as it continues.
All right. Thank you so much, Tim.
right. Thank you, sir. Again, you're always welcome here, and I look forward to speaking to you again soon. Ladies and gentlemen, as always, don't take my word for it. Definitely don't take their word for it. Take a little time, do your own research, and always be prepared to put in a little bit of your own effort if you really want to tap into the truth. That's got to be it. Hope you had a great week. Hope you have an even better upcoming week. And we will be back next Sunday. Thanks, and see you again soon.
Heartbreak, but it wasn't